Howard Session, the Honorable Mark E. Rettenwald, Marie K. A. Watanabe, and Daniel R. Foley presiding. Please be seated. Case number 27429, Liberty Mutual Insurance Company versus Sentinel Insurance Company. Attorney appearing for plaintiff appellant cross appellee Liberty Mutual Insurance Company is Thomas Tsuchiya Yama. Attorney appearing for defendant counterclaimant appellee cross appellant Michelle Labrador is Philip L. Carey. Argument on the merits.
Good morning. I'm Mr. Tsuchiyama and Mr. Carey. It's my understanding, Mr. Tsuchiyama, that you'll begin up the argument today. You'll be addressing both your appeal and cross-appeal. Mr. Carey, then you'll respond both as to the appeal and as your argument as to your cross-appeal. And then, Mr. Tsuchiyama, would you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
At this time, yes, we do.
Okay, how much time did you wish to reserve?
5 minutes.
Okay, so 25 minutes followed by 30, and a 5 minute follow. Thank you. Very good. Proceed, Mr. Tsuchiyama.
Morning. May it please the court, Thomas Tsuchiyama for plaintiff appellant Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. First of all, I'd like to say that it's been a while since I've been in this courtroom, and my client and I would like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue this appeal. This is a rather perplexing declaratory relief case that could clarify or otherwise modify this court's prior ruling in Karasawa versus TIG. As we see it, the primary issue really is, can a claimant deliberately create a shortfall in her tort and UM recovery, then backfill it with UIM benefits? By collecting $60,000 less than what Labrador could and should have collected from the underlying primary policies, Labrador created a $60,000 deficit, which she later sought to compensate for by collecting underinsured motorist benefits. She created a shortfall in this current controversy by settling for $30,000 of Sentinel's $50,000 UM limits and by settling for $60,000 of Pemco's $100,000 UM limits, and by not collecting any of the $100,000 in liability coverage available under the Sentinel policy. There was a total of $350,000 in primary liability and UM coverage waiting for Labrador, but she only took $190,000 of this. Now, as was pointed out in our brief, Your Honor, it's been a while since I've looked at that, and I think Mr. Carey probably knows better why it was not discovered until much later. I understand there's a time delay, but it was not, to my understanding, at all hidden from Mr. Carey or his client.
I've got a slightly different question, which is, when did your client discover the existence of that policy, and what efforts had it made when it was notified that there was a potential settlement involving PEMCO? What efforts did it make at that point to reasonably investigate and determine whether there was another policy?
Your Honor, I did not look at that aspect of the particular case, but my understanding is that there was no attempt from our standpoint to hide the limits. In the case, I believe Ms. Tolfrey herself did not divulge that she had a second policy, and she may have believed that that policy was no longer available. And so my recollection is that she did not disclose that second policy.
Is that kind of information available to another insurance company? Is that public record information? Or how would you go about finding it if the defendant in this case or the driver didn't disclose it?
Your Honor, I don't know the exact mechanics of how an insurance company would discover that. But in this case, Your Honor, I don't, to my knowledge, did not result in any prejudice with regard to the recovery ultimately by the claimant. And that she was free to, I believe, at that time to collect whatever amount was subsequently discovered from the second policy.
They had already given a general release.
A big pardon?
They had already issued, given a general release to the earlier insurance company. to the torque freezer, so it wasn't possible to recover from the second entrance.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it was not something that, again, that Liberty Mutual had perpetrated at all to try and hide that second. In fact, it would be to their benefit to actually discover this policy and reveal it to the claimant, because that would mean that there's more insurance money available to
collect. Claiming the gap, right? So he claimed the credit for that insurance policy, even if it was not known to the claimant at that time. Although you said it would have been to their benefit to disclose that information, you're now trying to claim the benefit of that non-disclosure by toll-free by claiming credit for the limits of the body injury policy.
You know, although they did manage to look like collect UM benefits under that same policy. I don't know, you know, why it was that they did not discover that earlier, but I don't know if there's a law that says it necessarily is the mutual's obligation to discover if there are additional policies available. And as the court might know, it is rather unusual, and sometimes in other jurisdictions, I believe it's not even allowed to have two policies on a car. But in this case here, there was no policy covering that vehicle, and so the assumption would be that there is insurance, and it probably is not a second insurance policy. Most people don't have two insurance companies for the same car.
How long? The policy was for the out-of-state policy, right?
Every car?
PEMCO policy, I believe, was the one that the settlement was made under, the $100,000 settlement in 1996.
That's correct, right.
Well, I suppose, Mr. Tsuchiyama, and then perhaps you can move on with your discussion of the facts and get onto the application of some of the law, but I suppose the question with regard to the non-settlement with Sentinel is who should bear the risk of there being an undisclosed insurer out there. Does it fall on the insured, or does it fall on the insurance company? Position is it should fall on the insured.
Well, that is our belief, Your Honor. And I don't know of any case law that says that the insurance company is obligated to determine whether there are other insurance policies.
Can I also ask, I think Liberty Mutual is the one that pointed out to Tom Free Labrador that Mrs. Tolfrey said there was an uninsured motorist, a phantom truck that was involved. How did you come upon that information?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that came from Labrador herself and perhaps Tolfrey as well.
Okay, under the statute, to be an uninsured motorist, you have to file an accident report within 30 days or something like that. Was that done here?
I don't know the answer to that, when it was disclosed. My understanding was it was disclosed much, much later.
Well, Mr. Tsuchiyama, perhaps address the UIM issue and why you think it is that there shouldn't be underinsured motorist coverage in the circumstances of this case.
On that, Your Honor, we have basically two arguments on that. First of all, we have a question with regard to the trial court's math in this particular case. As the court knows, the total arbitration award was $250,000, and the parties agreed that Liberty Mutual was entitled to a $200,000 credit for underlying BI policies. And the final thing, Your Honor, and the court held that Tolfrey was jointly and separately liable with the unidentified driver, and Liberty Mutual was obligated to pay $50,000. That's $250,000 of the award minus $200,000 credit, equals $50,000. And by the way, Your Honor, that kind of might have mooted the court's prior concerns about the coverage, because the parties did stipulate in trial court that we are entitled to a $20,000 liability credit. That is in the order.
You mean $200,000?
Yes, sir. Now, But if toll-free and unidentified driver were jointly and severally liable, we question why the trial court didn't factor in the amount that Labrador actually recovered from the unidentified driver. recovered $80,000 in UM benefits from the essentially the phantom driver, which means that when you combine that with $200,000 credit that was agreed to, she constructively received $280,000, which is $30,000 more than Labrador was than the award. So she was completely compensated. That aside, we believe the court should have considered the total of UM limits available to Labrador in determining whether toll-free was indeed uninsured. And that would dovetail with the trial court's ruling in the order granting in part and denying in part Liberty Mutual's motion for summary judgment. In that order, the court held that Liberty's other insurance provision was valid, and that between Liberty and Sentinel's policy was primary with regard to UM benefits. Applying the same rationale, we think that all of Liberty Mutual's UM and UIM benefits should have been excess to all of PEMCO's and Sentinel's liability and UM coverages. Considering Liberty Mutual's excess insurance clause and the fact that PEMCO and Sentinel covered the toll-free vehicle itself, Liberty Mutual should have had no obligation to pay unless the total arbitration award exceeded PEMCO's and Sentinel's combined $350,000 BI limits. Those were the underlying primary limits. Now, if the court decides that the trial court's calculations were erroneous, it need not decide the joint and several issue. We believe the court should, however, consider that as well. The court said below that UM and insured tortfeasors are jointly and severally liable, and UIM is essentially available to fill in the gaps for any shortfall in recovery. Because the $50,000 trial court ordered for the individual to pay essentially compensates for the unidentified driver's negligence.
Counsel, isn't there some support for that in the statute? The UIM statute says that the insurer must provide coverage for injuries suffered by any person legally entitled to recover damages from the owner or operator of the underinsured motor vehicle. Legally entitled to recover damages. Was not Ms. Labrador legally entitled to recover the full amount of her damages, $250,000, from Ms. Tolfer?
Well, we disagree, Your Honor, and they're actually severally liable, and they can only recover the amount that's attributable to the unidentified driver, and we believe there's ample support for that. The court cited the Karasawa case.
However, come back to the statute, counsel. I mean, I'm reading the statute, which, of course, you would agree would govern any contrary provision of the policy, correct?
Correct, yes, the policy does say that, Your Honor, but...
the policy kind of tracks that language. So once again, legally entitled to recover damages from the owner is not Ms. Labrador legally entitled to recover $250,000 from Ms. Tolfrey, who then has the opportunity or the right to seek contribution from the unidentified motorist.
Well, again, Your Honor, the plaintiff essentially was made whole anyway, as you pointed out, with regard to the math that was involved in this case. I mean, essentially, she recovered $280,000 constructively. $200,000 credit plus $80,000. But that aside, Your Honor, I think, again, the problem that we have, and I respect we have to philosophically disagree with the court's holding in Karasawa, because I believe the uninsured driver is severally liable. It cannot be joint and several. And I say this for several reasons. I understand the Karasawa case is near and dear to Justice Watanabe's heart, but let me explain. In that Karasawa case, you had two insured drivers, and that was Rennie and Young, and one uninsured driver. Now, if the liability of Rennie, Young, and the UM motorist was joint and several, as the court held, then the claimant, Karasawa, could have recovered all his damages from the two insured drivers because they're joint and several. And this court recognized that. And as the court pointed out, the two insured tortfeasors could then cover the excess amount they paid from the uninsured tortfeasor. That's true, but that recovery would not come from Karasawa's UIM carrier, TIG. You see, because TIG only insured Karasawa. It did not insure the uninsured motorist. So the two insured tort fees actually had no recourse against TIG. They would have to sue the uninsured motorist himself or herself. That's why I expect to believe this court may have confused contractual with tort liability in the Karasawa case. Now, if liability was several, Karasawa could only collect uninsured motorist portion of the award from his own UM carrier, TIG, which should have been the case, we believe. If it's joint and several, TIG should have been entitled to Taylor credits. Of course, Taylor came in after Karasawa, but it should have been entitled to Taylor's credits for the tort fees liability limits, and Karasawa can then collect the UM portion of the award, which are damages attributable to the unidentified driver, from the two insured tort fees. And TIG's excess clause, which I assume was present, would have kicked in under that circumstance. Now, there's.
I got a little confused that I have to tell you, looking at these policies, because the statute defines, the way I look at the statute, uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage are first party insurance. It covers the person who buys the insurance in the event that they or their family members get hit by some uninsured motorist. But in this case, all the policies basically expand the definition of an insurer to include somebody who's occupying a vehicle, which is not the definition of the statute. I think under the bodily injury statute, you have to cover occupants of the vehicle, but I don't think it covers necessarily uninsured or underinsured. But in this case, they got uninsured motorist coverage.
And I appreciate Your Honor's analysis on this. However, again, we are applying the joint tort feeser liability statute, which is a statute applying in tort and references judgments. And as we point out, there are two cases directly on point that say that that tort statute applies to actions in tort. So therefore, that joint and several concept is a tort concept. It is not a contractual concept. And
so
if
the court has said on numerous occasions that uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is personal. It follows the individual who buys that insurance policy. So if you take that position, why should Liberty Mutual be able to? I buy insurance. I expect my insurance company to protect me when I get sued by another.
Right, Your Honor, but again,
why should I have to go through all these hoops to be able to claim an insurance?
Again, Your Honor, you're imposing a tort concept on contractual claim. And let me point out another case. In this case. And unlike Karasawa, which is, I believe, a cap-type arbitration, there was a kind of arbitration between Labrador and Liberty Mutual. Toll-Free did not participate in that. Toll-Free and the unidentified driver were not held liable in tort in that proceeding, and a judgment was not entered against any party. The arbitration was a contractual proceeding. Under that circumstance, joint and several liability cannot apply. The Washington Supreme Court, in a subsequent case in 1999 called Allstate Insurance Company versus Vatican, Vatacan, which is at 139 Washington 2nd, 443, held that the liability of insured motorists and uninsured motorists is several, not joint. And it cited the arbitration reason. It says, quote, arbitration is not required by our UAM statute. It is a choice these parties freely incorporated into their insurance contract. By agreeing to this arbitration clause, these parties diminish the prospect of joint and several liability under the UIM coverage by contracting to allow a determination of liability and damages caused by the underinsured motorists in an arbitration prior to or in lieu of judgments against the actual tort feasors. So, well, I understand, and I do provide the UMUIN work. The arbitration clause is pretty much incorporated into virtually every policy, although I know of one insurance carrier that incorporates an option for trial. But to my knowledge, that is pretty much a uniform provision.
So it's an adhesion contract, you're not really agreeing to arbitration.
Big pardon?
So you're not really agreeing, I mean, the person who's buying the insurance isn't really agreeing.
I guess we could say that, but I don't know of any court that says that it's unenforceable or invalid. And certainly our HRS does not state that such arbitration clauses are against public policy or invalid.
But you're arguing that because arbitration basically is determining the policy liability rather than the liability, that we can't apply 27.
That is part of the reason. One is the contractual arbitration, and secondly, I believe the court is mixing and matching the various types of policies, UM, UIM, and BI. And there are decisions that says that you cannot reapply that. We cited to two of them, and we have a broad decision by the Supreme Court saying that the vehicle cannot be insured and uninsured at the same time. And so therefore, by essentially paying UM or UIM benefits to an uninsured vehicle, you're making that vehicle both uninsured and underinsured at the same time. It's looking at the broad picture here.
Are you talking about that state case where they said you can't collect both UM and bodily injury because you're basically converting UM to liability insurance?
Essentially, that's what you're doing when you're flying joint and several liability as between insured and uninsured vehicles, and you're applying underinsured benefits to compensate for any shortfall by the uninsured motorist.
So did I understand you earlier to say that you think the UIM coverage in the Liberty Mutual policy is excess to the UM coverage in the other two policies?
Yes, we've briefed that in our answering brief, I believe, in response to Labrador's brief. And the court actually found in our favor on that excess insurance provision.
No, the UIM, with regard to the UIM coverage, as opposed, I understand it found the UM was excess,
right.
But the UIM is excess to the UM and the other policies?
Well, it did not. I don't think that issue was before the trial court.
I thought I heard you say that today.
Well, Your Honor, I mentioned that the order held that the UM provision was, that the court held that, but I'm stretching the rationale that I believe that excess clause should also apply in the UIM order.
That wasn't before the trial court.
But that was not before the trial court, yes, Your Honor.
Let me just, if I could, turn to the question of the amount of, assuming that, like, the trial court, or what the circuit court did here, which is, I guess, you would characterize it as finding joint and several liability applies, what is the proper offset for the other coverage that might be available? As I understand it, the circuit court found the only offset should be bodily injury policies, which were $200,000. So $250,000 damage offset, $200,000 for bodily injury. Your position is that you should be offsetting the other UM coverage, either what actually was paid or what was available. I guess my question to you is, again, is the UIM statute relevant in this instance, and does it, in your view, provide support for the circuit court's action or opposition to it when the UIM statute defines an underinsured motor vehicle as a car for which the sum of the limits of all bodily injury liability insurance coverage applicable at the time of the accident is less than the liability for damages. So the definition of what is an underinsured vehicle by the statute is tied in to the bodily insurance liability limits. Now, does that provide support for the circuit court's approach of only looking at the bodily injury liability limits, since that is, of course, the definition of what's an uninsured vehicle? If not, why not?
I'm sorry, are you reading the provision for...
reading the definition of what is an underinsured vehicle in the statute. That definition is, it's a vehicle for which the sum of the limits of all bodily injury liability insurance coverage is less than the liability for damages. So the very definition in the statute appears to define the analysis in terms of what bodily injury or bodily injury liability coverage is available. It does not mention the availability of UM coverage.
Well, Your Honor, and again, we would go back, in our belief, to again liability being several in this case, and in our opinion, based upon the available coverages, there was no underinsured vehicle in this case at all, because there was $200,000 essentially for toll-free, of which she was found liable for $150,000, and there was more than ample amount as well for the uninsured vehicle. Assuming that UIM benefits are payable for that vehicle. So, in our opinion, if you apply several liability in this case, there is no underinsured vehicle. And if you combine both, like I believe the trial court should have, there is no shortfall. 200,000 plus 80,000 collected in WEB is 280,000.
Well, that's exactly my question. The trial court, there appears to be some support, at least appears, and I'm not saying by any means that's my own belief, but I'm just saying that appears to have been what the trial court was relying on.
Yes.
Why was that wrong in your view?
Either way, it's wrong, because as I mentioned, if you separate liability, there's enough coverage for toll-free, and there's enough separate coverage for the uninsured motorist. If it's joint, you have to combine the all the limits that were available from both sides.
Based on what? What's your
support? Just joint liability. I think you have to look at all the policies, all the limits that are available to satisfy the award.
Jeffrey is quoted the statute, which says that you just the tailored lot only applies to bodily injury liability. It doesn't cover uninsured motorists or uninsured.
Right. But again, if we look at it that way, then I would say that she was found there was actually $200,000 worth for toll free, of which she was found liable for $150,000. So the bodily injury liability limits exceed anyway.
That's if you apportion, if you have an innocent several liability. But the question presumes a joint several liability. But we're getting to the second part of the analysis, and I realize that you don't believe we should be going down this road, but if we were going down this road, I'm asking for the support for your belief that we should or there should be an offset for the UM. Does that come from the statute, fundamental fairness, public policy, the policy? Where does it come from?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's just basic application of joint and several. That, if you have two tort feasors and they have sufficient policies, 901 is essentially underinsured, at least vis-a-vis the claimant. Now, one could overpay the amount of a judgment, and if that's the case, then the one that overpaid, of course, might be entitled to contribution against the one that underpaid. But they would not be underinsured necessarily vis-a-vis the claimant, because the claimant can still be made whole. And again, you know, I think that even if you literally apply the reading of the definition of underinsured motorist, I still believe that it is based upon, it would have to be based upon several liability cases, because the joint tort feasor statute does not apply in these type of contractual proceedings.
Great. I guess your time has expired. You have 5 minutes reserved, and should we just have you save the remainder of your argument for that time?
Yes, sir. I appreciate that.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Carrick?
Thank you. Morning. Other insurance provision was applied to the uninsured motorist coverage here. However, only one of these policies had underinsured coverage. And the reason for that is that toll-free had two policies at the time of the accident, one with PIMCO, one with Hartford. Labrador had one policy for her family, and her father bought it, and that was the Liberty Mutual policy. Well, the two liability policies, PIMCO and Hartford, they also, in their language, had UIM benefits. However, cannot get liability benefits from those policies and then get UIM benefits. And for that reason, that left only the Liberty Mutual policy as the one that had applicable UIM benefits.
Now, UIM and UM policies are very similar in nature, and some states, I think, they're merged, actually. So shouldn't we apply the CAD versus State Farm principle that you cannot get dual recovery for liability and UIM benefits, like you can't get dual recovery for liability?
That actually could be argued, but that doesn't even apply here because we're not even, we've never collected liability benefits from Liberty Mutual, never have asked for them, never would get them. Liberty Mutual did not cover the toll-free vehicle. So if we had collected liability benefits from Liberty Mutual, maybe you could argue we couldn't get UM or UIM benefits, and under Kane, we couldn't get UIM benefits.
Did you get those?
Certainly, and maybe we couldn't get UM benefits. But since we haven't gotten any liability benefits from Liberty Mutual, we never could because they weren't a liability policy. They were just the Skrulls family policy. And so, basically, they're the only ones that have an applicable UIM policy under insured policy. Now, if you leave aside everything else that happened in the case and you say, okay, well, there were two liability policies, each for $100,000, PEMCO and Hartford, and so you have to give an offset for $200,000, which we've always agreed that's applicable. So you get the offset for $200,000, and then what's left? Well, you have a claim for underinsured benefits because that's the only liability benefits that are out there is the $200,000. So, leaving aside all the other claims for UM and everything else, we could have certainly made the claim for the UIM benefits against Liberty Mutual, the only company that had UIM benefits we could go after, because there's $250,000 of damages, and you deduct the $200,000 of liability coverage available. Certainly, you can go after that $50,000. Now, they can come in and say, well, but we don't like the way that you did all these other things to go after that other $100,000 that was lacking in the beginning. And by the way, there's two possibilities. Toll-free, when she didn't disclose the Hartford policy, was either just forgetful or didn't realize that it applied. See, it was her new policy here in Hawaii. PEMCO was the Washington policy. The other thing is she might not have wanted her accident care to apply to the Hartford policy, her new policy, which then might have raised her rates here. She might have just thought she could get away with having PEMCO cover her from Washington and reported it to them. In most cases, $100,000 is a lot of coverage. But anyway.
You got a lawsuit against her, a separate lawsuit?
That's correct. And settled it, like Your Honor said, with a general damage release before Liberty Mutual brought up the fact that this Hartford policy of $100,000 existed. When we found that out, we did have an option of saying, hey, that's fraud. You know, you misstated what your coverage was. We're going to go in and try to get the general release overturned and pursue that $100,000 that way. But on the other hand, Liberty Mutual or any of the other insurers could have said, well, that's unfair that Hartford hasn't paid its $100,000, and they could have done things like that also. But
just to be clear, you're conceding that $100,000 should be counted as an offset. So in other words, the issue of whether you should have done it, they should have done it, it was due diligence, it wasn't due diligence, and pursuing that other $100,000 either initially or after the disclosure was made is off the table for our purposes today because you conceded that $100,000 should be counted against or an offset against the available, the $250,000, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether you collect it or not doesn't matter. It's whether it's there and the coverage was there. So even though we didn't collect that $100,000, we have to give an offset for that $100,000 when we go after underinsured coverage. And so we did give an offset for that, and we are still giving an offset for that when we go after Liberty Mutual's UIM coverage.
Initially, we went after Liberty Mutual for uninsured motorist coverage, right? And they made a settlement offer and then pulled it off the table after they found, I guess, this fact.
That's correct. Initially, they had made an offer, and then they took that offer away, and then when it became clear that you did not have to exhaust benefits in order to make a UIM claim, they said, well, you're still not entitled to it because we don't think the damages here are over $200,000, so we're still not going to pay the UIM benefit.
You didn't pursue a lawsuit, a fraud lawsuit to set aside the settlement with Ms. Tolfrey?
No.
No.
There was mention of a separate lawsuit that was brought in the circuit court. I don't know if it was against the insurance companies or...
The only suit was Liberty Mutual's deck action, our initial liability suit, wherein we collected the PIMCO policy limits. I did amend the complaint in the deck action to include a claim for bad faith for alleging that Liberty Mutual took a statement of people early on and knew there was a UM claim and didn't disclose that, didn't send us that statement or anything, and that they knew there was a UM claim and didn't disclose it to us, amongst other things, including failing to reasonably investigate the claim. But those are the only suits that I believe are out there.
If you could come back to the uninsured motorist claim and address this issue of why there shouldn't be an offset of some kind for the either the availability or the actual payment of uninsured motorist benefits. In other words, the methodology of the circuit court in this case was to say $250,000 in damages, $200,000 in bodily injury limits, therefore $50,000 in underinsured. Why doesn't it make sense to, as Liberty Mutual argues, consider the fact that there's $150,000 in uninsured motorist coverage out there, and in fact, she had obtained $90,000 under those two policies. Why isn't that something? Why, in your view, should that not be on the table, or shouldn't it be considered?
Well, when considering UIM benefits, certainly you give a credit for all the liability coverage that's out there. But when considering the uninsured motorist claims, we were in a position where there was a $50,000 Hartford policy, a potential $100,000 PIMCO uninsured policy claim, and a potential $140,000 Liberty Mutual uninsured claim. We did it pro rata, on a pro rata basis is the reason we settled with Hartford for $30,000 and PIMCO for $60,000. And Liberty Mutual, had they gone along with that pro rata basis, would have paid $80,000 or $85,000, I forget which it was. But they didn't pay. And so that left us, had they paid that, certainly we wouldn't be here. We would have collected the whole $250,000 worth of damages.
I understand they didn't go along with the settlement proposal, but having gotten past that point, what I think I'm interested in hearing your analysis of is the district, this part of the circuit court's methodology in calculating the offset. Right out of the box, I think Liberty Mutual's argument here today was it's unfair, doesn't adequately or fairly reflect the policies of the statute mandating UIM coverage to say that there shouldn't be an offset for the availability or actual payment of UM benefits. And I ask for your argument on that point, whether case law, statute, policy, or whatever in your view is the reason why the circuit court was correct in not taking into account the availability of UM coverage in determining the amount of the offset?
First of all, I don't understand Liberty Mutual's offset argument as to why they should get an offset for UM benefits paid. But we're going by the statute and going by the contract, which says you can go after UM benefits, going by Carasalvo, which says you can go after whichever person or company is liable until you get all of your damages paid. And if someone doesn't like how you're going after someone else and they think that that is unfair as to them, they can join in and try to get contribution for some other relief that way. But at the point where we were looking at going after Hartford because of toll freeze fraud, or going after uninsured motorist benefits, to us it looked a lot easier going after the benefits that our family had paid for these policies, rather than trying to prove that some kind of fraud had taken place, and then proving in a jury trial that the damages were $200,000 or whatever we would have had to do to collect that full $200,000. To us, it looked easier to go through binding arbitration and collect UM benefits or UIM benefits, whichever it turned out that it was easiest to collect until we got fully compensated.
So it's a timely, I mean, are there considerations of timeliness in terms of effectuating the policies of the statute that support your position? Is that your intention?
That when Liberty Mutual discovered that it wasn't necessary to exhaust UIM coverage, I guess. What's your basis for saying you don't have to exhaust your liability limits for UIM coverage?
Oh, well, the law says you don't have to exhaust UIM coverage in order, or I mean, liability coverage in order to go after the UIM coverage. You just have to give a credit to for whatever liability coverage is available. And so that's how we would proceed. I'm not sure if I answered anything there. Unless your honors have any other questions, I'll stop there.
If you have anything further, did you have anything to add on the UN issue or anything else? So if not, that's fine, Council.
No, you're right.
Mr. Tatsuchiyama, please.
Thank you,
Your
Honor. I would only point out, I don't know if this qualifies as a rebuttal, but we did point out that there are cases that are directly on point in this case. Two subsequent cases that came down after the court's ruling, the trial and circuit court ruling in this case, and we cited those two, Illinois Farmers versus Hall, and in that case, the court held that although the UM carrier steps into the shoes of the uninsured motorist, the joint and several liability does not apply to contractual UM claims. And in the other case we cited that also is on point, Kentucky Farm Bureau versus Ryan, it held that a UIM carrier's liability to its insured is limited to damages caused by the underinsured tortfeasor. It does not include damages caused by a phantom motorcyclist. In other words, it's essentially saying it should be several liability for paying contractual claims.
Was there the statutory or the underlying statutory provision the same as the one that I was discussing with you earlier in those states? And if so, how did they address the statutory issue that I raised to your attention earlier, which is the language that says coverage must be provided for injuries suffered by any person legally entitled to recover damages?
Well, yeah, I don't believe that they particularly addressed that provision, but they did review a similar type of joint several liability type statutes that we have here that apply in torts and that could apply to a judgment as opposed to these type of private arbitration proceedings. And as we talked about earlier, I believe it's, that provision cannot be read alone, and that it means that we, you pay for damages attributable to that Aldrich, it does not say that joint and several applies, nor does the policy say that joint and several applies. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. There stands in recess.
All right.